Blackstone Audio presents The Glass Cell by Patricia Highsmith. This book is read by Tom Taylorson. To my dear cat Spider, born in Palisades, New York, now a resident of Positano, my cellmate for most of these pages. Chapter 1. It was 3:35 p.m. Tuesday afternoon in the state penitentiary, and the inmates were returning from the workshops. Men in unpressed, flesh-colored uniforms, each with a number on the back, streamed through the long corridor of A Block, and a low hum of voices rose from them, though none of the men seemed to be talking to anyone nearby. It was a strange, unmusical chorus, and it had frightened Carter on the first day. He'd actually been green enough to think that a riot might be in the offing, but he accepted it now as a peculiarity of the state penitentiary, or perhaps of all prisons. Cell doors stood open, and into certain cells along the ground floor and along the four tiers above, certain men vanished, until the corridor was nearly empty. There would be 25 minutes now in which to wash up at the basin in the cell, change a shirt if one cared to or had a clean one, to write a letter or listen with the earphones to the disc jockey program that was always on at this time. The bell for supper rang at 4. Philip Carter was walking slowly, dreading the sight and the company of his cellmate, Hanky. Hanky was a short, chunky fellow, in for 30 years for armed robbery, bargaining, and murder, and seemingly rather proud of it. Hanky didn't like Carter and called him a snob. There had been several minor tiffs in the 90 days Carter had spent with him. Hanky had noticed, for instance, that Carter disliked using the single seatless and exposed toilet in the cell in his presence, so Hanky made his own use of the toilet as noisy and vulgar as possible. Carter had taken this with good-natured indifference at first, but 10 days ago, when the joke had become rather old, Carter had said, "Oh, for God's sake, Hanky, cut it out." And Hanky had become angry and called Carter a worse name than snob. They had stood up to each other with fists clenched for a moment, but a guard had seen them and broken it up. After that, Carter had kept a polite and cool distance between himself and Hanky, handing him the single pair of earphones, if he was nearer to them, handing Hanky his towel or whatever. The cell with its two bunks was too narrow for one man to pass another comfortably, and, by tacit agreement, if one man was up, the other took to his bunk. But this week Carter had a piece of bad news from his lawyer, Tutting. There was to be no retrial, and since 90 days had passed, a pardon was out of the question also. Carter faced the fact that he was going to be in the cell with Hanky for some time to come, and that he should perhaps not be so hostile and aloof. The atmosphere between them was not pleasant, and what did it accomplish? Hanky had sprained his ankle last Friday, jumping off the truck that took the inmates back and forth to farm work. He might at least ask Hanky how his ankle was. Hanky was sitting on the edge of his lower bunk, fondling his incomplete deck of dirty playing cards. Carter nodded to him and glanced at his bandaged ankle. "How's your foot today?" He unbuttoned his shirt and headed straight for the basin.
"Oh, so-so. Still can't walk on it."
Hanky lifted the bedding at the foot of his bunk and produced two packs of Camels that he had been hiding there. This Carter saw as he straightened up, drying himself with his small, rough towel. Hanky didn't smoke. The ration was 4 packs a week, which the inmates bought with their own money. The inmates' salary was 14 cents a day, the cigarettes 22 cents a pack. Hanky saved up his own ration and sold it at a profit to other inmates. The guards knew about Hanky's sideline and winked at it, because Hanky occasionally gave them a pack or even gave them a dollar.
"Do me a favor, Cart. Take these to number 13 down here and number 48, third tier, one to each. I don't feel like walking that far. They're paid for."
"Sure." Carter took them in one hand and started out, buttoning his shirt with the other hand. Number 13 was only 2 cells away from his and Hanky's cell. An old Negro with white hair sat on the lower bunk.
"Cigarettes?"
Carter asked. The Negro rolled sideways on one fleshless hip and pulled a small piece of paper out of his pocket. With stiff black fingers, the Negro pushed Hanky's receipt into Carter's hand. Carter stuffed it into his pocket, tossed a package of Camels on the bunk,
and went out. He walked toward the end of the corridor where the stairs were. The guard called Mooney, a nickname for Moonin, quickened his slow walk and frowned as he came toward Carter. Carter had the other pack of cigarettes in his hand. He saw that Mooney saw it.
"Delivering cigarettes?"
Mooney's long, thin face scowled harder.
"You gonna start delivering milk and newspapers, too?"
"I'm taking them for Hanky. He's got a sprained ankle."
"Let's have your hands."
Mooney took his handcuffs off the clasp of his belt. "I didn't steal the cigarettes. Ask Hanky."
"Your hands!"
Carter held out his hands. Mooney clicked the handcuffs on his wrists. At the same instant, two toilets nearby flushed simultaneously, and simultaneously Carter saw over Mooney's shoulder a pimply-faced, pudgy inmate smirking slightly with vague pleasure as he watched. A few seconds before, Carter had thought Mooney might be joking. He had seen Mooney and Hanky joking a few times, Mooney even swinging his stick playfully at Hanky. Now he knew Mooney wasn't joking. Mooney didn't like him. Mooney called him the professor.
"Walk to the end of the block,"
Mooney said. Mooney's voice was loud. While Mooney had been talking to Carter, a silence had fallen in the two or three cells in either side of the block which could observe them, and it was spreading over the whole ground floor. Carter walked, with Mooney behind him. At the end of the corridor were two stairways going up to the second tier, the elevator's barred doors that Carter had only twice seen open for hospital cases on their way up, and two plain doors, their fronts flush with the stone wall, with large round locks on them. One led to the next cell block, B block, the other to the hole. Mooney stepped in advance of Carter and swung off his big ring of keys from his belt. Carter heard a soft, collective groan from the men watching, a hum as anonymous as a wind.
"What's the matter, Mooney?"
asked a voice, so self-assured Carter knew before he glanced behind him that it was a guard's.
"Got the great engineer here delivering cigarettes,"
Mooney said and opened the door.
"Step down,"
he said to Carter. The stairs went down. This was the hole. Carter paused after a couple of steps. He had heard about the hole, even if the inmates exaggerated, and he was sure they did exaggerate. It was a torture chamber.
"Listen, an offense like this, doing a favor for Hanky, it's just a few demerits, isn't it?"
Mooney and Chernever, who was coming along too, chuckled superiorly, as if at the remark of a half-wit.
"Get going,"
Mooney said.
"You already got more demerits than I can count, or you either."
Mooney shoved him. Carter kept his balance, then descended the steps, watching his footing carefully. For if he fell, he could not easily save himself with manacled hands. He had taken a fall the day he was put into prison, and at that time his handcuffs had been shackled to a heavy leather belt. It was true that he had a lot of demerits, but they were mostly due to the fact he did not yet know everything he could and could not do. You got demerits for not keeping in step in a line marching to the mess hall, for saying excuse me or saying anything on the way to the workshops, but not on the way back, for flicking a comb through your hair at certain times, for looking too long at a visitor, a stranger, perhaps, man or woman, through the double-barred wall at the end of A block, and four times, due to demerits, Carter had been unable to see his wife on Sunday afternoons. This was doubly infuriating, because on each occasion the two letters per week that he was permitted to write had been sent to Hazel too early to tell her that if she came that Sunday, he could not see her. There was no list of regulations anywhere that an inmate could read and so avoid committing misdemeanors. Carter had asked some inmates for all the ways of incurring demerits, and he had listened to 30 or 40. And then one inmate had said with a reconciled smile,
"Ah, there must be about 1,000 of them. Gives the screws something to do."
Carter supposed now that he was due for 24 or 48 hours of solitary in the dark. He took a deep breath and tried to be philosophical about it. It wasn't going to last forever, and what were 3 or 6 missed meals of the lousy food they served here? He regretted only missing his daily letter from Hazel, which would be brought to his cell around 5:30 p.m. Carter's feet found level stone. There was an unfamiliar dampness in the air and a familiar scent of stale urine.
Mooney had a flashlight, but he used it to guide his and Chernever's steps behind him, while Carter went ahead into darkness. Now on right and left, Carter could see the small doors of the cells he had heard about, tiny black holes that a man could not stand up in, big step-ups at the doors so one had to crawl into them. The prison had been built in 1869, Carter remembered, and these must have been part of the original prison, the part beyond improvement. The rest of the prison was said to have been improved at one time.
The hose? Chernever asked in a low voice.
Something stronger. Here we are.
Stop. Go on in.
They were beside a cell with no door at all, a cell with a very high, open doorway. As Carter walked in, he heard from another cell a groan or a grunt and the snuffle of a nose. There was at least one other person down here. It was comforting. The cell was huge compared to the one Carter shared with Hanky, but there was no bunk or chair or toilet in it, only a small round drain in the center of the floor. The walls were of metal, not stone, black-gray and red from rust. Then Carter noticed hanging from the ceiling a pair of chains that ended in black loops.
"Give me your hands," said Mooney.
Carter extended his hands.
Mooney removed the handcuffs.
"Cherny, old pal, can you get me a stool from Summers?"
"Yes, sir," said Chernever, and went out, drawing his own flashlight from a pocket. Chernever returned with a square wooden stool like a small table, which he set down below the chains.
"Step up,"
said Mooney. Carter stepped up, and Mooney after him. Carter raised his hands before he was ordered to. The straps were leather with a rubber lining, and they buckled.
"Thumbs,"
said Mooney. Obediently, Carter turned up his thumbs, then realized with a shock what Mooney intended. Mooney fixed the straps between the first and second joints of his thumbs, then buckled them tightly. The straps had holes every half inch and all along their length. Mooney stepped down.
"Kick the stool away."
Carter was strung so high he was on tiptoe and could not kick it away. Mooney gave the stool a kick that sent it a couple of yards in front of Carter and turned it over. Carter swung. The first stab of pain prolonged itself. Blood rushed to the tip of his thumbs. His back was to the guards, and he expected a blow. Mooney laughed, and then one of them kicked him in the thigh, and he began to swing back and forth, twisting a little. Then a push in the small of his back. Carter suppressed a groan. He held his breath. Now sweat trickled in front of his ears, down his jaw. Carter's ears were ringing loudly. He smelled cigarette smoke. Carter wondered if they had a time limit, vaguely a time limit, such as an hour, 2 hours. How much time had passed already? 3 minutes? 15? Carter was afraid he would scream in another few seconds. "Don't scream," he told himself. The screws would love that. Muscles down his back began to flutter. It was hard to breathe. He had a brief fantasy that he was drowning, that he was in water instead of air. Then the ringing in his ears drowned out the guards' voices. Something struck him in the back. Water hissed over the stone floor in front of him, and a bucket bounced and clattered. Everything seemed in slow motion. He felt much heavier, and he imagined that the two guards were hanging onto his legs.
"Oh, Hazel," Carter mumbled.
"Hazel?" a guard said.
"That's his wife. Gets letters from her every day."
"Not today, he won't."
Carter felt his eyes were bulging from their sockets. He tried to blink. His eyes felt dry and huge. He had a vision of Hazel walking nervously up and down in his cell, wringing her hands, glancing at him now and then, saying something that he could not hear. The scene shifted to the trial. Wallace Palmer. Wallace Palmer was dead.
"Then what do you think he did with the money? Come now, Mr. Carter, you're an intelligent man, a college graduate, an engineer, a sophisticated New Yorker.
Your Honor, that is irrelevant. You don't sign papers not knowing what you're signing."
"I knew what I was signing. Receipts, invoices. It wasn't my job to know the exact price of things. Palmer was the contractor.
The prices could have been raised on the receipts after I'd signed them, raised by Palmer. I did not know our material was second rate, and I told him so. Where is the money, Mr. Carter? Where is the $250,000? And then Hazel was on the stand, saying in her clear voice, My husband and I have always had a joint bank account. We've never had any secrets about anything to do with money. With money. With money.
Hazel!
Carter cried. And that was the end of it. Several buckets of water sluiced over him. Behind him, voices seemed to be chanting. There was chanting and laughter. They faded, and he was alone again. He realized the chanting was the pulsing of his own blood in his ears. He imagined his thumbs 2 feet long now from the pulling. He was not dead. Wallace Palmer was dead. Palmer, who could be made to talk if he were not dead. Palmer had fallen from the third-floor scaffolding down to the ground beside a cement mixer. Now the school building was finished. Carter saw it, dark red and 4 stories high. It was shaped like a wide U, like a boomerang. An American flag waved on top of it. It stood, but it was made of bad materials. The cement was no good. The plumbing didn't work. The plaster had started cracking before the building was completed. Carter had spoken to Gawill and to Palmer about the materials, but Palmer had said that it was okay. That was what they wanted. The school board was cutting corners, and it wasn't their concern if the building materials were bad. Then the word got around, and the safety board, or whatever they called it, said that children ought not to be allowed to set foot in it, that it all might fall on their heads. And the school board had not been cutting corners. They had paid for the best. And who was responsible? Wallace Palmer was responsible. And maybe a few others in Triumph had got a share of the $250,000. Gawill could hardly have been blind to what was going on, for instance. But Philip Carter was the chief engineer, worked closest with the contractor Palmer, was an out-of-towner, a New Yorker, a wise guy, a man out to feather his nest at the expense of the South, a professional man who had betrayed the honor and trust of his calling, and the state was going to have his blood. Let the school stand empty until the next hard wind blows it down, said the prosecuting attorney. A disgrace, and an expensive disgrace for all the state to look at. 2 men came and took him down. Carter's head cracked against the stone floor. Clumsy attempts to carry him. Curses. They left him crumpled on the floor while they went away again. Carter retched, but nothing came up. The men returned with a stretcher. The journey was a long one, down corridors that Carter barely saw through partly opened eyes. Up stairs after stairs they went, Mooney and somebody else. What was his name? The one of last night? Or when? Up they went, nearly sliding him backward and head first off the stretcher. Then along corridors, narrowish ones, where inmates, Carter knew from their flesh-colored clothes, and a few Negroes in blue overalls, also inmates, stared in silence as they passed by. Then the smell of iodine and disinfectant. They were going into the hospital ward. He lay on the stretcher on a hard table. A voice was murmuring angrily. It was a nice voice, Carter thought. Mooney's voice replied,
He's out of order all the time. He's out of order. What are you going to do with guys like him? You should have my job, mister. All right, speak to the warden. I'll tell him a thing or two myself.
The doctor spoke again, lifting Carter's wrist.
Look at this.
I've seen worse, said Mooney.
How long was he hung up?
I don't know. I didn't string him up.
You didn't? Who did?
I don't know.
Would you mind finding out? Would you mind finding out?
A man with round, horn-rimmed glasses and a white jacket washed Carter's face with a large wet cloth and squeezed some drops from it onto his tongue.
Morphine, Pete, said the doctor. A whole half grain.
They rolled his sleeve higher and gave him a needle. Pain began to ebb quickly, like a flood receding, like an ocean drying up. Like heaven. A pleasant, sleepy tingling invaded his head. Lightly dancing like gentle music. They began to work on his hands, and he fell asleep during it.
Chapter 2
When Carter awakened, he He was lying in a firm white bed on his back, his head on a pillow. His arms lay outside the covers, and his thumbs were huge lumps of gauze as big as the rest of his hands. He looked to the right and left. The left bed was empty. The right held a sleeping Negro with a bandaged head. Pain seeped back into his thumbs, and he realized that it was the pain that had awakened him. It was growing worse, and it frightened him. He looked at the approaching doctor, wide-eyed with fear, and realizing that he looked afraid, Carter blinked his eyes. The doctor smiled. He was a small, dark man of about 40.
"How are you feeling?" asked the doctor.
"My thumbs hurt."
The doctor nodded, still faintly smiling.
"They took some punishment. You'll need another shot."
He looked at his wristwatch, frowned slightly, and went away. When he came back with the needle, Carter asked,
"What time is it?"
6:30. "You had a good sleep."
The needle went in, stayed a few seconds.
"How about something to eat, before this puts you to sleep again?"
Carter did not answer. He knew from the light at the window that it was 6:30 in the evening.
"What day is it?"
"Thursday. Scrambled eggs? Milk toast? I think that's all you'd better try. Ice cream? Does that appeal to you?"
Carter's brain turned tiredly over the fact that this was the kindest voice he had heard since entering the prison.
"Scrambled."
Carter was in the ward for 2 days before they removed the bandages, and then his thumbs looked enormous to him, and they were bright pink. They did not look as if they belonged to him or to his own hands. The thumbnail was tiny in the mass of flesh, and they still hurt. The morphine shots came every 4 hours, and Carter wished they were more often. The doctor tried to be reassuring, but Carter could see that he was worried because the pain did not diminish. His name was Dr. Stephen Cassini. On Sunday, Carter was allowed no visitors, whatever the state of his demerits, because he was in the ward. At 1:30 p.m. on Sunday, when the visiting period began, Carter imagined Hazel in the big, gray-green lobby downstairs, protesting that she had come to see her husband and that she was not going to leave until she had seen him. Dr. Cassini had written a letter to her, which Carter had dictated, saying that he would not be able to see her, and the letter had been smuggled out sometime on Friday. But Carter was not sure Hazel had received it by Saturday. Carter knew that if she had, she would come anyway, because he had said his hands were slightly injured. But he also knew that the double gates of gray bars in the lobby, the officials in uniforms who examined identifications of visitors and checked on inmates' status, would defeat Hazel at last. And he writhed in his bed and pressed his face into his hard pillow. He got her last 2 letters from under his pillow and reread them, holding them with his 2 fingers.
"Darling, Timmy is bearing up pretty well, so don't worry about him. I lecture him daily, though I try not to make it sound like a lecture. The kids are picking on him at school, of course, and I suppose human nature wouldn't be human nature if they didn't."
And in the last letter,
"Darling Phil, have just spent over an hour with Mr. Magrin, the lawyer David has recommended all along over Tutting, you know, and I like him very much. He talks sense, is optimistic but not so optimistic, like Tutting, that you start to get suspicious. Anyway, Tutting has now said there is nothing more he can do, as if there weren't the Supreme Court, but I wouldn't even want Tutting handling that. I have paid Tutting off, that is, the last $500 of his fee, so if you're quite agreed, Magrin can take over. Magrin said it will cost $3,000 to have a transcript of the trial typed up for the Supreme Court, but you know we can afford that. He wants to see you as soon as possible, of course. Oh, damn it, darling, those idiotic regulations I'm greeted with every Sunday. 37765's demerits do not permit him to have visitors this week. And for being out of step in a cafeteria line, you said. For goodness sake, darling, do your best to conform to their stupid rules. Magrin is also writing to the governor direct. He will send you a copy of the letter. You must not worry. Like you, I know this cannot go on forever, or even very long. 6 to 12 years? It won't even be 6 months.
Magrin's fee would be at least $3,000, Carter thought, and the $3,000 for the transcript besides would just about clean out their ready cash. Every figure seemed astronomical.
$75,000 for his bail, for instance, which of course they hadn't been able to raise, and Carter had not wanted to ask his Aunt Edna for it. Their $15,000 house was mortgaged. Their Olds was worth $1,800, but Hazel needed it for marketing and also for driving the 27 miles on Sundays to see him. Or try to. And now his thumbs were out of joint. That was the final absurd fact. The doctor called it something else, but essentially that was what it was, and an operation, according to Dr. Cassini, would be of very dubious value. The prison, in which Carter had thought a couple of weeks would not be unbearable, not even a serious episode in his life, had now branded him forever. He would never have much articulation in the second joints, and a sort of hollow would remain below them. He would have funny-looking thumbs, and he would not have much strength in them. Imaginative people, seeing them, might guess what had caused the deformation. He wouldn't be able to deal a hand of bridge so adroitly, or whittle a bow and arrow for Timmy, and by the time he got out, Timmy might not be interested in bows and arrows anyway. He had written to Hazel within a couple of hours after the removal of the bandages that day, Sunday, holding the pen in a wobbling fashion between his index and middle fingers, and he had to tell her what had happened, ghoulish as the story was, to account for his strange writing. But he minimized it and said it had been for several hours instead of nearly 48. His thumbs were permanently deformed because a man called Hanky, for some strange reason, had it in for him. Why? Because he hadn't shown Hanky the picture of Hazel?
"You got a wife? You got her picture? Let's see it,"
Hanky had said the first afternoon of their acquaintance. Carter had said as amiably as he could, "Oh, some other time."
"You ain't got a picture?"
That had been his opportunity, perhaps, to show it and appease Hanky. But he had muffed it. The picture he carried in his wallet of Hazel was cut out of an enlargement of a color photograph in which she was standing in the snow in front of their New York apartment on East 57th Street, hatless, her dark hair blowing, laughing, a wonderful typical expression on her face, which was why Carter preferred the picture. And what possible pleasure could a pig like Hanky get from looking at a picture of a woman with the beaver collar of her coat pulled up to her chin? Sunday afternoon, around 4, Dr. Cassini came in and made his rounds of the 40-odd patients in the ward. When he came to Carter, he said, "Well, Carter, want to try taking a few steps?"
"Absolutely,"
Carter said, sitting up. Pain streaked down his back, but he did not let it show in his face. He staggered at the foot of the bed and had to catch his balance on the doctor's extended hand. Dr. Cassini smiled and shook his head. "You keep worrying about your thumbs. Do you know those knots in your legs were shutting off the circulation, and you could have got gangrene? Do you know only yesterday morning you were running a temperature of 103, and I thought you might be in for pneumonia?" Carter was glad to sit. He felt faint.
"When is this going to go out of my legs?"
"The knots? With time. And massage. Walk around the foot of the bed if you like, but don't try anything more," Dr. Cassini said, and moved on to the next patient. Carter sat there breathing as if he had been running. He remembered what Dr. Cassini had said yesterday, that he was, after all, 30 and couldn't recuperate from an experience such as his as quickly as a 19-year-old. Dr. Cassini had a cheerful, matter-of-fact way of talking about the whole, and the victims of it whom he had treated, that gave Carter an eerie feeling that he was in a madhouse instead of a prison, a madhouse in which the caretakers were the madmen, as in the old cliché. Dr. Cassini seemed to pass no judgment on what happened in the prison. Or was that quite true? Dr. Cassini had asked him yesterday what he was in for, and Carter had told him. "Most fellows? I don't bother asking why they're in," Dr. Cassini had said. "I know already. Breaking and entering, bargaining, car stealing. But you're not like the most of them." Dr. Cassini had asked what school he had gone to. Carter had gone to Cornell. And then why he had come south. Carter wished he had asked himself that, 8 months ago, when he and Hazel had decided to come. Carter had come because the offer from Triumph Builders had sounded very good. $15,000 a year plus various perquisites. "What did Palmer do with the money, do you think?" Dr. Cassini had asked, and Carter had said, "Well, he had a girlfriend in New York and one in Memphis.
He saw one or the other of them every weekend. He was always flying off somewhere on Fridays. He bought them cars and things.
And Dr. Cassini had nodded and said, "Oh, I see."
And he did. And he believed it, Carter thought.
It was true, but it had not been believed by the Court of Quarters Sessions. Even when the girls were brought down and questioned, it hadn't been believed that Palmer could spend $250,000 in about a year on two women, and that the two women between them had nothing more to show for it than one mink coat worth about $5,000 and one diamond bracelet worth about $8,000. Nobody seemed to know or care that Palmer could eat and drink about $500 worth a month, and did, or that his airline tickets cost him anything, or that both girls had got rid of expensive automobiles just before they came down for the trial, or that Palmer might have salted some away in Brazil. Carter crept back into bed. While he had been sitting on the edge of his bed, the Negro with the bandaged head had stared at him, unblinking, as if he watched a boring movie. Carter had tried to talk to him a couple of times, but had got no response, and Dr. Cassini this morning had told him that the Negro had abscesses in both ears, had had a series of them, and that he did not expect to preserve much, if anything, of his hearing. He reread Hazel's last four letters, one that he had had in his pocket when they strung him up, and the three that had been delivered since. Carter held them between his fingers while his fat thumbs throbbed in unison, like silent drums between his eyes and the pages. Hazel had put a drop of her perfume on her last letter, which was the most cheerful of the four. The male nurse Pete came with the morphine needle and silently prepared it. Pete had only one eye, the other was a sunken hollow, whether the result of disease or injury, Carter couldn't guess. The needle slid into his arm. In silence, Pete went away, and Carter lifted his letters again. As the morphine stole through his blood, he began to hear Hazel's voice reading her own words, and he read all the letters as if they were brand new. He heard also Timmy's voice interrupting her, and Hazel saying, "Just a minute, sweetie, can't you see I'm writing to Daddy?" "Oh, all right, your catcher's mitt. Why, it's right there in front of you, on the sofa. That's a fine place for it, anyway. Can't you take it up to your room?" Timmy socked a small fist into the undersized mitt. "When's Daddy coming home?" "Just as soon as..." "When's Daddy coming home? When's Daddy coming home?" Carter changed his position in bed and forced himself away from that vision, lay passive with his eyes on Hazel's writing until another vision swam into its place. He saw their bedroom. Hazel stood by her dressing table, brushing her hair for the night. He was in his pajamas. As he moved toward her, she smiled at him in the mirror. They kissed. A long kiss. With the morphine to enhance memory, it was almost as if Hazel lay beside him in the hard bed. Carter could watch his visions as if they took place on a stage. No one was in the theater but him. He was the sole spectator. No one had ever seen the show before. No one ever would but him. Here the voices of the inmates were shut out. At least for his ruined thumbs, he had been granted a few days of quiet, more or less. A groan of pain from someone, the clatter of bedpans, were like music compared to the excretory sounds of 6:30 a.m. in the cell block, or the insane titters in the night, like women's laughter, and the other no less deranging sounds of men who sought relief by themselves. Who was mad? Carter wondered. Which ones of them? Which jurors and which judges out of the thousands who had sent these 6,000 men here? Chapter 3. It was Wednesday before Carter could walk. Dr. Cassini got him a new suit of prison clothes, which fitted him better than the ones he had been wearing. He was still weak. His weakness shocked him. "It's not unusual," said Dr. Cassini. Carter nodded, his mind baffled and blank as it always was when the doctor spoke in his matter-of-fact way about the whole.
"But you said you'd seen other cases? Like mine?"
"Oh yes, a few. After all, I've been here 4 years. Look, I'm not saying what they do is right. I've sent letters to the warden. He promises to look into it. He fires a guard or has him transferred."
Dr. Cassini's hands flew out in a hopeless gesture. Then he adjusted his rimmed glasses nervously and blinked at Carter.
You try to fight City Hall, and you go crazy. I'm not going to be here much longer. He nodded, as if to confirm himself, and Carter immediately became suspicious. It's time for another shot for you, isn't it? Carter wrote a letter to the warden, whose name was Joseph J. Pearson, with regard to Moonen and Chernever. He had intended to make the letter brief, calm, and to the point. The result was such a masterpiece of understatement, Carter was seized briefly by an attack of mirth. It read, Dear Warden Pearson, I should like to call to your attention that on the afternoon of March 1st, I was strung up by the thumbs in one of the basement rooms of the institution for nearly 48 hours. I was repeatedly revived with buckets of cold water when I fainted. The result is that my thumbs are permanently damaged, the second joints having been pulled from their sockets. The guards who did this are Mr. Moonen and Mr. Chernever. I respectfully request that you exercise your authority in regard to this incident. Yours faithfully, Philip E. Carter, 37765. P.S. I would be grateful if I could have a full list of prison rules and regulations so that I may avoid an accumulation of demerits in the future. Carter had heard from one of the inmates that Warden Pearson was scrupulous about acknowledging letters of all sorts, but never answered any of them. At any rate, Carter dropped the letter in the slot marked intramural, and that was that. Patience and fortitude, he thought. It was going to be a long, slow fight, whatever Hazel thought. He was going to see Hazel on Sunday. Dr. Cassini had put in a special request that he might see his wife. In just 72 more hours, he would see her for 20 minutes. A cheerful fatalism buoyed him up. They couldn't very well kill him before Sunday afternoon, so nothing seemed to stand in the way of his seeing Hazel. In the hospital ward, it was impossible to acquire demerits, because he was not actually doing anything, walking anywhere, or using any prison tools or facilities other than the toilet. He reread Wuthering Heights and wrote to Hazel. My darling, imagine sitting in prison and reading Emily Bronte. Things are not so bad, are they? Please do not worry. Above all, don't get angry if you can help it. I was angry the first few weeks here, and it got me nothing but a lot of demerits and ill will from the guards. Best not even to feel the anger if you can help it. Make like the yogis or the passive resistance boys. We are up against something a lot bigger than we are. I'm glad Timmy is doing better with his reading. Glad also he is not getting any heckling lately at school. Or are you sure? He would tell you, wouldn't he? But I'm not so sure. He might frown and be silent. Is he frowning and silent? Tell me. I am writing him a letter next, so you will miss one from me. But meanwhile, tell Timmy I think he is great for doing such a good job as man of the house while I am not there. I mean, snow shoveling. After all, a half inch of snow is a rough job. Am helping out in the ward as much as I can. Bedpans and other charming chores. Don't worry about my hands. I'm not writing too badly, as you see. I love you, darling. Phil. The effort of writing tired him like hard labor, and the writing was pretty bad, wobbly and nearly every letter separate from the next.
Mr. Carter? Said the Negro urgently. Mr. Carter?
Carter went to the foot of the Negro's bed, lifted between his two palms the bedpan from the low table there, and slipped it under the covers.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome, Carter murmured, although the Negro could not hear him. On Sunday, Carter took extra care with his shaving. It was another great advantage of the hospital ward that he could shower and shave daily, instead of twice a week being herded with the others to the showers and the barbers. He had a second shower at noon, and he also shined his heavy shoes. He took as much trouble with himself as he had for his wedding, and he considered telling Hazel that, and decided not to, because she might not think it very funny. Carter pressed his baggy trousers in a room down the hall from the ward which had an iron and an ironing board and a sink in it. Then he put on the white shirt that inmates were allowed to wear on Sundays if they had a visitor. It was a short-sleeved shirt with over-long collar tabs. Inmates were not allowed ties because they might hang themselves, Carter supposed. But at least the shirt was white, and a change from flesh color was a treat. He looked at himself in the mirror by the ward door and tried to see himself as Hazel would. There were depressions under his eyes, though they were not dark.
Certainly his face was thinner. And he looked at least 35, he thought, not 30. Even his lips seemed thinner and more taut, even his head narrower. But that was due to the prison haircut, of course. His blue eyes looked out at him like the eyes of another person, tired, hard, and vaguely suspicious. Dr. Cassini walked up and slapped him on the shoulder.
All dolled up, eh, Philip?
Carter nodded, smiling, and suddenly his heart began to beat faster with excitement. He had a feeling of giddy anticipation, as if time had turned back and he were about to call for Hazel on a date, rushing back down to Gramercy Park in a taxi with a box of flowers across his lap, running up her front steps two at a time, and Hazel opening the brown door with the brass knob before he touched the knocker.
Want another shot?
No, I'm okay. Thanks. His thumbs were starting to hurt a little, but he didn't want another shot now, at 12:30. He had had a shot at 10, and he thought it should last until 1:50, when Hazel's visit would be over. By 1:10, the jabs from the pulses in his thumbs were growing more acute, and Carter was tempted to get a quick shot from Pete, which he could have had just for the asking, but he decided to stick by his little vow to himself that he wouldn't, just before he saw Hazel. He had Pete bandage his thumbs so they would not shock her. He went down in the elevator with his pass signed by Dr. Cassini and the guard named Clark in the hospital corridor. Carter had to show the pass 3 times, each time acquiring a new signature or initials before he reached his old A block, at the front end of which was the entrance to the visiting room. By then, he was beginning to feel weak in the knees. Carter saw Hanky's blobby figure walking ahead of him and along the left side of the corridor, heading for their old cell, probably. Carter slowed his walk so that he would not overtake Hanky or be seen by him. Carter peered through the bars as he walked toward them, but he could not identify Hazel among the figures in the waiting area. The lobby, or waiting room, had benches like church pews with an aisle down the middle. At the back, near the outside door, was a coffee vending machine and a candy and gum machine. Between the cell block and the waiting room was an area of some 20 feet square enclosed on 2 sides by walls, and on the other 2 sides by bars that went from floor to ceiling. This enclosure was called the cage. There were always 2 guards in the cage, and the 2 doors were never opened at the same time, nor was a visitor ever allowed in the cage while an inmate was in it, even if the inmate was only handing the outgoing mailbag to a guard. In the cage, to the right as one faced the waiting room, was a locked door through which visitors were admitted to the visiting room 1 floor below the block. Inmates who had visitors were admitted by a door near the cage in the corridor. Carter saw Hazel when he was about 20 feet from the cage. She was standing at the tall desk on the right in the waiting room, showing her identification card to the officer there. Carter's heart floated up in his chest, and he slowly turned around so that the guard who leaned against the wall on his right would not assume he had come to stare.
"Santos!" called the guard by the prisoner's entrance door.
"Here!"
a man trotted forward.
"Colligan!"
Sullen, indifferent, vaguely envious faces watched as men in white shirts detached themselves from the sluggish mass in the corridor and came alive, hurrying to the visiting room door with their passes.
"Carter!"
The guard took his pass, scribbled on it, and motioned him through. Carter went down the dimly lighted stairway. It led to a long room divided by a glass wall with a shallow, table-high shelf and straight chairs on either side of it. Nearly all the chairs were taken. The visitors had their entrance at the other end of the room and on the other side of the barrier. There were 4 armed guards, 1 in each corner of the room. Carter kept his eyes on the visitor's door as he walked, looking for Hazel. Then she came in, and he moved forward, still looking at her, toward a free chair which was on the other side of the barrier, pointed to it, and managed to find an empty chair for himself. Hazel wore her blue tweed coat with a bright scarf tucked in at her neck. To Carter, the colors she wore seemed spectacularly brilliant and beautiful, like flowers or birds' plumage. Her red lips smiled, though her eyes were tense. She looked at his hands. Carter pushed his underlip out, smiled, and shrugged.
"They don't hurt. You're looking wonderful."
He tried to speak loudly and distinctly because of the glass.
What do they say is the matter with them? Did they say anything else?
Hazel asked.
Nothing else.
Carter swallowed and glanced at the clock. He sat on the edge of the hard chair. Before he knew it, the 20 minutes would be gone, and he was already wasting precious seconds in silence. Except that he was seeing her.
How is Timmy?
Timmy's all right. He's fine.
Hazel moistened her lips.
You've lost some weight.
Not much.
Mr. Magrin said he would come today to see you.
Her voice reminded him of clear, cool water. He had not heard a woman's voice in 6 weeks.
It's wonderful to see you.
Carter was annoyed by the voice of the man on his left, who was talking to a man in a dark suit on Hazel's right, perhaps the inmate's lawyer. The inmate was saying in a loud, annoyed voice,
I don't know. I just don't know. Why do you keep asking me that?
The inmate's voice was louder to Carter than Hazel's.
Did you get a statement yet from the doctor?
She asked. His thumbs pulsed more quickly. His forehead was cool with sweat.
He has to take more x-rays. He can't say what's the matter yet. Not entirely.
Then it's worse than you told me, isn't it?
I just don't know, honey. It's the joints.
Tell me the names of the guards who did it, Hazel had written in one of her letters. It's absolutely illegal in this day and age. The word illegal was strange in view of some of the things he had seen in the prison. What about the old man in A block whose false teeth had broken in half and who couldn't get them fixed and couldn't eat anything now but soup? Was that a legal way to treat a man in jail? Carter felt he was choking, as if he might burst into tears. I only want to put my head in her lap, he thought, and he sat up straighter.
I'll get the statement from Cassini as soon as I can.
David can use it, you know,
Hazel said earnestly.
David? I thought Magrin wanted it.
David said he'd take it to the governor in person. David's a lawyer too, you know. He'd take it sooner than Magrin, right away.
Who's handling my case, Sullivan or Magrin?
Carter said quickly. His hands rested on the table like a boxer's. The thumbs pulsed as if blood were going to come shooting out the tips of the bandage at any moment.
I hear you're seeing Sullivan a lot,
he said, and saw in her face that he had hurt her.
I see him as often as I tell you I see him. I'd really be down in the dumps without him, Phil. All the neighbors calling and dropping in. What can they do? David at least knows something about the law.
That might be. Might be something we'd all better forget about.
What?
The law. Where is it? What good is it?
Hazel sighed.
Oh, darling, you're tired and you're in pain.
She reached nervously into her bag for a cigarette, started to extend the pack to Carter before she remembered the barrier that went all the way to the ceiling.
Haven't you got a cigarette?
I forgot 'em. I don't want one. It doesn't matter.
He did want one, and he watched her closely as she lighted it. Her hands shook slightly. A frown put a line between her brows. Her forehead was very smooth, quite without lines. Her complexion was very clear, and to Carter it seemed now so beautiful it was unreal, like something painted on canvas or on glass. There was a natural pinkness in her cheeks and in her lips. She had a small mouth and the softest lips Carter had ever seen, or kissed. He wondered if Sullivan had kissed them, or if Sullivan ever would.
What are the guards' names?
Hazel asked.
Were you afraid to write them in a letter to me?
Carter glanced to the right and left automatically.
I wasn't afraid. I just thought it might get censored. It's Moonen and Chernover.
Moonen and what?
Her dark blue eyes looked directly at him.
Chernover. Chernivr.
I'll remember. But I want you to get that statement immediately from the doctor. The x-rays can wait. We'll get another statement about those.
Okay, honey.
He racked his brain for something cheerful to say to her, some incident to make her smile. There had been laughter in the ward over a few things, but now he could not think of one. Carter smiled.
Sullivan taking you out to dinner tonight? As usual?
As usual?
Her frown was back.
I meant, it's Sunday. You usually see him on Sunday evenings, don't you?
I wouldn't say usually. Phil, I tell you every time I see him, and what we talk about, and even what we eat.
That was true, and Carter clamped his teeth together. It was only Galwell who had made a couple of cracks in his last letter, and Galwell was no doubt exaggerating or making things up.
You never mention what you eat,
Hazel said. Carter could suddenly laugh a little.
I don't think you'd care for it.
Hog jowl? And other things unidentifiable that had their prison names.
You can complain to me. I only wish I could share it with you.
The pain in his thumbs made his mind swim. He spoke to keep alert.
I don't like to think of you here. I don't want you to know all about it, because it's too disgusting. Sometimes I don't even want to look at the picture I have of you here.
She looked surprised and also frightened.
Darling, I don't mean I don't want you to visit me. My God, I don't mean that.
The sweat rolled down in front of his ears.
2 more minutes, said the guard, strolling behind Carter.
Carter looked wildly at the clock. It was true.
Mr. Magrin said he'd already written to the warden about your thumbs, Hazel said.
Well, the warden won't reply to it,
Carter said quickly.
What do you mean? It's a letter from your lawyer.
I mean,
he said, trying to sound calmer.
He'll acknowledge the letter, but he probably won't refer to the stringing up. I know he won't.
Hazel wrung her fingers together. The cigarette trembled.
Well, we'll see. Oh, darling, how I wish I could cook a few meals for you.
Carter laughed, a laugh as if someone had crushed his chest.
There's an old fellow here named Mac, nearly 70. All he talks about is his wife's cooking. Apple pies, venison sauerbraten, popovers. Popovers! Imagine!
Carter burst out in another laugh, his shoulders shaking. And he saw Hazel laugh too, almost in her old way. And it transformed her face.
It's funny because...
Carter wiped tears from his eyes.
Because all the other guys talk about how they miss their wives or their girls in bed or something. And he talks about food. He spends all his spare time making ship models or making one ship he's been on since I got here. It's 4 feet long, and his cellmate complains because it takes up too much room. He's just up here.
Carter waved a hand sideways and up to the right, as if Mac's cell were visible.
Time's up, said the guard.
Carter half stood up, his lips apart, staring at Hazel.
Hazel was already standing up to leave him. That's the first person you've told me about here. Tell me more. Write me. See you next Sunday, darling.
She blew him a kiss, turned, and went. He began the long walk back down the cell block. He had to have another shot before he could sit through 20 minutes with Magrin. Near the end of the cell block, he looked left, and at last he came to Mac's cell. The door was open, and Mac sat there on his straight chair, so absorbed in the delicate sanding of his ship's hull that he did not notice Carter looking at him. The ship was not yet painted, but Mac had made great progress since Carter had last seen it. The rigging looked finished.
Hello, Mac, Carter said.
My name's Carter.
Oh, hello, hello,
Mac said, cordially but not recognizing him, and turned back to his work.
Got time for a visit?
No, sorry, I haven't. Some other time.
Carter walked on. Mac had made some kind of peace with himself, and for that Carter envied him. Mac hadn't even noticed his bandaged hands, and that was somehow comforting to Carter, too. Mac hadn't even seen him, Carter thought. Only heard his voice.